this lecture this morning. And if you'll permit me to just give a brief introduction, okay, as deserving of our esteemed speaker this morning. Rabbi Jeremy Leder is a Yeshiva University's Joseph and Gwendolyn Strass Professor of Talmud in the Mezer Yeshiva Program, a Rosh Yeshiva at the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, and an adjunct professor in Bible at Yeshiva College. Rabbi Leder is a prolific scholar with more than 900 lectures on Judaism, captured on audio and video and available online. Rabbi Leder was one of the first Americans to win the International Bible Contest. He graduated summa cum laude from Yeshiva College in 1991 and received an MS in American Jewish History from the Bernard Revel Graduate School of Jewish Studies. He was ordained at Reitz and holds a PhD in Judaic Studies from New York University. With great pleasure, introduce Rabbi Leder.
Thank you very much. And Terry, thank you very much for hosting this morning. Most of the people in the room, except for those who are actually my students here, will remember the name Bernie Goetz. And the story goes back to, I think I was in high school, it was in the mid-80s, and that was the first time I encountered the term vigilante. And he had apparently been mugged many times in the subways, chose to carry a gun, there was another attempted mugging, and he defended himself by shooting the assailants. According to the stories in the time, I don't know whether it was true or not, he also, again, I don't know if this is true, but he was accused of looking at one of the youths who had been shot by him already, looking at him and saying, "You don't look so bad," and shot him again. That was at least, I don't know that that was true. We know eyewitness testimony is not always reliable. But it really was the first encounter with the notion of what I'll call Ovid Inish Dina Lanafshe, the person's right to sort of perform justice on their own behalf. I want to really limit my comments this morning to the question of lenafshe, for one's self. There is a larger question of it in ishdina, whether one is allowed to act in general, not for one's own benefit, but for society's benefit. There is one case which I have omitted from the Gemara in Bava Kamma that actually deals with the situation the way one answer in the Gemara understands, that a person is simply engaged in what I'll call kfiya datit, you know, in religious enforcement. But most of the discussion, and certainly the discussion in the Shulchan Aruch, is limited to the question of a person acting on one's own, on behalf of one's own, really financial interests, or something like that. So I would term it Ovid Inish Dina Lenafshe. Now, there is a passage in the Torah which we often don't think about in this particular light, but I think is actually very much relevant, which is the story of Baba Machteres. And the story of Baba Machteres is often misquoted or misunderstood. As the Torah tells us, in Baba Machteres yimatzei haganav ukava meisein lo damim. Right? So if, in fact, a thief, in the parasha of Geneva, the Torah interrupts the amount you pay by telling us that if he's caught tunneling into your house, and he's killed in the process, then the balabayas, the homeowner, is not liable, he's not responsible for the death of the person. People often cite this as the justification of self-defense in Judaism, but in fact it's not correct. This is not the source of what is known as self-defense, what is classically referred to as rodef. It's a totally different halacha, and it differs in a number of ways. The source for rodef is actually located in the parsha, not of murder, but in the parsha of rape, of Nara Hamarasa. And the Torah there draws an analogy to someone who tries to kill his friend, and Chazal understand that as being the source of self-defense, the right to protect one's own life. But Baba Machteres differs in three significant ways. Number one, in the case of rodef, one is not allowed to provoke a rodef. It's not clear to me that if you go into this, if there's someone who is armed, and you go and start tugging on their beard, stepping on their feet, and provoking them, that you're now, when they pull out their gun, that they're actually considered a rodef. It's entirely unclear what the status would be there. Rodef is when, in some sense, I would say totally unprovoked, but someone is actually pursuing you to kill you. The case of Baba Machteres is actually not so. And something that Rabbi Bleich has pointed out, actually, in his discussion of training of land for peace, said if the ganav comes into your house and you choose to lock yourself in your bedroom and let him steal your stuff, then that would be perfectly fine. There's no din of Baba Machteres. But you have a right as a homeowner to confront the ganav because that's a person's normal inclination, and you're not obligated to suppress that inclination. And therefore, the Torah says, since the norm is to confront the intruder in your house, and then the intruder knows that it's likely to turn into life or death and he's going to try to kill you, therefore you are allowed to kill the intruder. So Baba Machteres, in some sense, you can't provoke the person tunneling into your house, but before it has reached the situation of rodef, you're allowed to actually create the situation where you're actually allowed to kill the person, where you really have a choice. By rodef, as a general rule, you don't have a choice. The person has chosen to chase you, to try to kill you. You have no choice but to run or turn around and save your own life by killing him. Number two is the presumption of danger. I don't know exactly what the threshold is, but in order to qualify a road safety, the danger has to be clear and present, and it has to be of certainly an extreme statistical probability. The default assumption, it has to be, I don't want to talk about the preponderance of evidence, but it has to be very clear the person is coming after you to harm you. In the case of Baba Machteres, in a situation where there's a ganav, the default assumption is the person is coming to kill you unless you know otherwise. The Gemara points out the distinction between av ala bein and bein ala av, that when the assumption is that a parent would never kill a child. It's not always true, but it's a generally good assumption. Therefore, if the person tunneling into your house is your father, you're not allowed to kill him, even though it's at night, even though you don't know for sure, because the assumption is that your father wouldn't kill a child. But the other way around, and it means pretty much everybody else, the default assumption without any other knowledge is that the person is going to try to kill you, and therefore you're allowed to kill him. By Rodev, the evidence has to be absolutely clear. The default assumption by Rodev is probably that you're not allowed to kill the person. By Baba Machteres, you are. And that leads me to what I think is the third distinction and crucial for our discussion, which is what is the very nature of Baba Machteres versus the nature of Rodev. I picked a couple of examples here in the Gemara Sanhedrin, but if you learn through the Sugyos of Ben Sora and Mora that deal with Baba Machteres, and I take just one example, what you actually see is that Baba Machteres, far from being self-defense, it's actually someone who almost acts as the agent of Beis Din. Baba Machteres is a Din Torah. The Gemara, it may also have an element of self-defense, but the Gemara, and if you take a look at the second source, Tana Rabbanan, Damim Lo, Bein Bechol, Bein B'Shabbos. That the din, that you're allowed to kill the person, that you're not allowed to kill the person, damim lo, during the day, whatever that means, zarcha Hashem Shalav, it doesn't matter whether it's weekday or Shabbos. Ein lo damim, bein b'chol bein b'Shabbos. When you're allowed to kill him, it doesn't matter whether it's during the week or it's on Shabbos. So the Gemara says, b'shlama ein lo damim, bein b'chol bein b'Shabbos itzrich. You know why the Braisa has to tell us that the law of Baba Machteres and your right to kill him applies even on Shabbos? Salkadai techamina mida dahave aharuge beisdin. You might think that it's treated the same way as people executed in court. The b'Shabbos lo katlinon. Whatever the source is, lo sevaru eish b'chol moshva seichem yom ha-Shabbos, whatever that source exactly means, Chazal understand that beisdin cannot be manish on Shabbos. So when you're going to execute a person, despite the fact that it's a mitzvah saseh for Beis Din to kill someone who deserves to be killed, nonetheless, you're not allowed to do it on Shabbos. So one would have thought that by Baba Machteres, that you're not allowed to kill him on Shabbos. Why? Because you're not allowed to have a Din Torah on Shabbos. You're not allowed to have an Onesh Din. Now, the answer is, of course, you are allowed to kill him. Now, the Gemara doesn't explain why that is. One might explain one of two possibilities. Either because it's really not Din, it's really just self-defense, or because it contains also the element of self-defense. Aside from being Din Torah, a Din of Beis Din, it's also an element of self-defense. So even though from the perspective of executing the will of Beis Din, of acting on behalf of the Beis Din, you can't do that on Shabbos, but for protection of your own life, you're allowed to be Mechala Shabbos. And there, the truth be told, there are many other Gemaras in the Sugya that suggest the same idea, that there's an element of Mishpat of Beis Din that's being done by Baba Machteres. That is not the case by Rodev. Rodev is simply self-preservation. But Baba Machteres might be what we would call Ovid Inish Dina L'Nafshe. And clearly the Torah permits it. And in fact, it may even be a mitzvah. There is, however, one source that perhaps suggests the opposite. And that's the story of what we call, in rabbinic nomenclature, Boshes. And that's the story of two men who are fighting. And one of their wives steps forward, and in order to protect her husband from the person he's fighting with, she grabs him in an embarrassing way. And the Torah there says that v'katzo sas kapa lo sachosenecha. Chazal understand, doesn't mean you cut off her hand, but it means that she is financially liable for the shame that she has caused this person struggling with her husband. So here, it seems the woman has come forward, and simply to act, it's not her own, but if we assume that ishto kegufo, she's there protecting her husband, and nonetheless the Torah says that she's liable for her actions. Now, as one of the things that I think that this should go with that and should not have to be stated, which the Gemara will ultimately claim is the explanation here, is going back to the original story of Bernie Goetz. So he might have been certainly justified in pulling the gun and shooting the people who were trying to mug him. But I think it's also pretty clear that once someone was shot and I don't know if it's true or not, but pretend for the moment it was true. Once someone was disabled, shooting him again is not in the category of Ovid Inish Din L'Nafshe because it's not din. At that point, it walked into court. The court wouldn't rule that that's the proper punishment such a person. So whenever we talk about Avad Ish Dila Nafshe, the assumption is that that has to be actually the way the court would rule. In the context of the woman who grabs the other man, the assumption would have to be to say that this tells us that you don't say Avad Ish Dila Nafshe is only if she was entitled, fundamentally that's what the Beis Din would have ruled, or that was something which was proper and right. If, of course, and this is what the Gemara will say, she had an alternative means. She didn't have to grab him in an embarrassing fashion. She could have just grabbed him by his collar and pulled the other guy off her husband. So then there's no justification for doing what she did, in which case it's not Avad Ish Dila Nafshe, because it is Shelo Kedin. Okay. The primary focus, however, of the discussion of the Rishonim really centers on one sugya in Bava Kama. The sugya in Bava Kama tells the story about how Rav Chisda sent Rav Nachman a shayla about how much you pay for a certain kind of knas, for boshes. So if somebody hits his friend with a shovel, so obviously there may be physical damages, but it's also humiliating. So his question was, well, you know, how much do we assign? They like to, judges, you know, don't like to have to figure out all the details all the time. So if you have fixed rules that set, you know, how much you pay for X, Y, and Z, it makes the life of the judges a lot easier. So the first thing Rav Nachman, the great Dayan, sends back to Chisda. Rav Chisda, he says, what are you doing collecting knasos in Bava? We don't make people, but without a real Sanhedrin, without real musmachim, we don't have a din of boshes. We only are done dinim of what we call chisaron kis, when there's a direct, real, tangible financial loss. So he says, what are you judging knasos for? And he says, by the way, what happened anyway? Tell me the story. So he tells him the story. And the story goes that on the second line, Shalach Leida, Hu Gargusa de Betray, the Chol Yom Ahava Dali Chad Minai. There was a well that they used to alternate which days who got to draw from the well. There was a limited amount of water. I guess it was replenished, but basically you got to use it your day. Asa Chad Kadali Biyoma de Lodilei. One guy came, it wasn't his day, and he started to draw the water. Amar Leida, the guy says, Yome Didihu, it's my day. No Ashkach, but he didn't listen. Shako Panda de Maramache. He took the shovel, and the handle, the head, whatever it was, and he whacks him. So Amar Le, Rav Nachman says to Rav Chisda, you got the whole thing wrong anyway. Mea pande bepande lemchaye, afil, he should have hit him 100 times if necessary, and he's not chayv anything. Afilu leman de Amar lo avet inishdina lenafshe, even as we're going to see in a moment, it's a machlokas for Rav Yehuda and Rav Nachman whether, in fact, a person is allowed to execute justice for their own interests. Even if you say you're not, b'makom seda avet inishdina lenafshe, if the only debate, as the Gemara will say, is if you have a choice of taking the person to court. So why then would you be Avid Inish Dila Nafshe if you can take the person to court? The answer is because it takes time. And you have lawyer's fees, and you have everything else that it's going to cost. So therefore, better I do it myself. What do I need to bother everybody? Save time and money, and therefore I'll do it myself. So Rav Nachman said, if this pseida, if the loss is not going to be recoverable, here, the water, you know, you don't know, firstly, the water's not going to be available for me to water my crops today. And if I don't water my crops today, so my crops are not going to grow. And if my crops don't grow, well, I lose money. And I'm not going to be able to collect that money in Beis Din probably because it's grama. It's not direct nesek. So therefore, the only means I have available to me to collect is to stop him from taking my water today. So the Gemara now says, the Itmar, Rav Yehuda Amar lo Avid Inish Dila Nafshe, Rav Nachman Amar Avid Inish Dila Nafshe. So that's the Machlokes. Hecha de Ikapseida, Kule Amar lo Pli Yida Avid Inish Dila Nafshe. Everybody agrees, if you can't recover the loss, then you say Avid Inish Dila Nafshe. Ki Pligi Hecha de Lekapseida. Where you have the option of going to taking the person to Beis Din and recovering your loss. Rav Yehuda Amar lo Avid Inish Dila Nafshe, Dekhevan de Lekapseida, Lezel Kame Dayanus. Since you don't stand to lose, go in front of the Dayanim. Rav Nachman Amar, no, Avin Ishti Lanafshe, the Chayvan the Bidin Avin Lo Tarach. I don't have to bother going to court. As a side note, it's interesting, and not for now, but I'd be curious to know what the lawyers think. Note, Rav Nachman was the judge. Rav Yehuda was Rosh Yeshiva. And I wonder to what extent Rav Nachman's perspective reflects that he doesn't want to be bothered with more cases. It's easier for his, you know, if he gets cases off the docket, by individuals taking care of matters. Now, obviously, there's a flip side. You don't want a society, and we show him to point this out, where everybody goes and decides that, I'm right, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z because I'm right, and then, of course, you have chaos. But it did strike me that, I've seen this in other surgeries as well, where I wonder about Rav Nachman's perspective, because Rav Nachman really was the Dayan. He was married into the Reish Galusa, and it's clear that he's the one who we always say Hilchas HaKarav Nachman Bedine. Okay, The Gemara then goes on to cite, I'm not going to read them for now, I'd rather save some of the time to look at the Rishonim. The Gemara has several other examples in discussing who is correct, whether you say Avin Ish Din L'Nafshe when there is a Pseida. But I think that one of the things emerges from the Gemara is that everybody agrees that if there's an alternative available, that you're not allowed to strike the person, you're not allowed to do things that damage the other person. Everybody agrees that if there's no alternative, that even if it means physically confronting the other person, even if it means damaging their property, so then you're allowed, then we say Avin Ish Din L'Nafshe. One of the examples the Gemara has is if you fill up my courtyard, you know, with barrels. And that's great, but now I can't get out of my house to get to the street. So the Braisa says, I can just take my sledgehammer and smash my way out. And the only question is, am I allowed to smash my way only to make a path? Or can I smash every barrel in the chutzah that's not supposed to be there? So that's a case where basically I'm damaging your property in order to protect my interest. Now, to make a path out to go to Beis Din, that's a makom dikah pseida, because if I can't break a path to go out the basin, then obviously I have a lot of serious problems. But once I've shoveled the path through your barrels, at that point I could go to basin and say, look, this guy has put his barrels in my court, please tell him to remove them. And if he doesn't, well, then that's a different story. Then basin will send the shlich basin with a sledgehammer. Okay. So anyway, so the Gemara, it seems pretty clear, and I think this is true for all the Rishon, and that we paskin like Rav Nachman, that Avin Inishtin L'Nafshe, even V'mokom D'Lecha Pseida. Now, what exactly? Now, of course, the crucial question, though, are what are the parameters of Avin Ish Din L'Nafshe? Now, the tour begins by noting that Avin Ish Din L'Nafshe violates one of the basic rules of halachic jurisprudence, which is Al Tehi Don Yechidi. Right? When Avin Ish Din L'Nafshe, it really violates two things. Number one, you're a Dayan Yachid, and number two, you're a Nogea B'Davar. At that point, they don't even point out that you have a conflict of interest. But the tour writes as follows: Afal Pisha Yachid Eino Yachol Ladun. But Oseh Din Liatzma, Peirush Imroe Es Shelo Biyad Acher. If you see your possession in somebody else's rishus, Shegzalo, that you he stole the object from you, Yochol Lakachas Miyado Mashegzalo. You're allowed to take it. That number one, I can just go and take it. V'im Ha'acher Omeid Kinegdo Limchosvo. If the other person tries to block you, Yochol Lahakoso Ashenichenu Likach Shelo. You can beat him until he lets you take it. Not only if you're going to suffer hefseid by not getting it out, the other person is going to get rid of it in such a way that you'll never get it back. That's obvious. And you're potur on that which you strike him. Obviously, whether or not you're allowed to do din al nafshe, if I take, even if we rule that I'm not allowed to be of a din al nafshe, if I take my object and ultimately I win in court, I don't have to pay anything. The question would be, if I take my object, but in the process I beat you up. So by the rules of Chov El Umazik, I would have to pay you for the damages for beating you up. So that's the chiddush here. The chiddush is that even if I were right, if I weren't allowed to do Avid Inish Din L'Nafshe, then I'd keep my object, but I have to pay you for the chabala that I did to you. So the whole point is that I'm allowed to beat you up, and I'm not liable for any damages. In other words, it has to be obviously if I'm strong enough that I can just push you up with one hand and take my object and just walk away, I'm not allowed to physically injure you. It's only obviously if that's my only choice. But he says, even if there's no loss, if I wait, until I take you to the Torah, but I don't want to bother. So and here's the crucial line. Kevon shebaru lo shehadin imo, v'yachol lahotzi bedin miyado. Since number one, it's clear that he's right. Shebaru lo, though, it's clear to me that I'm right, and v'yachol lahotzi bedin miyado. And this is really crucial. And I could get it from you in a din Torah. Now that's significant, because walking into Beis Din and saying, well, I know that that's mine, Beis Din will say that's very nice, but do you have some proof? Do you have Edom? But at least this is the Torah's formulation, that Yochol Lahotzi Bidin Miyado, Yesh Lo Rishus Lahatzi Lashalo, Vafilo Ayideh Haka, Im Eino Yochol Atzi L'Binyan Acher. So that's what the Torah writes.
So is that subject to retroactive review by the court? In other words,
well, here's the very interesting part, and that's the question, what did the Torah mean by that? There is a way, the Torah
That ruling theoretically would narrow Ovid Inish Din Lafshe very to a very very small slice. In other words, it's not enough that I know that I could that it's mine. I actually have to win in a Din Torah. There is another way of looking at it, which is an issue that's discussed already in the Rishonim and then more so in the Nosei Kelim of the Shulchan Aruch. What about, in other words, one of the issues I want to talk about a few minutes at the end is the question of what's known as tfisa. Tfisa is a famous Aaron halacha where I see something, and now the burden of proof shifts halachically. Now you want to claim that back, so you have to, the burden of proof shifts to you. So in this context, the Acharon point out there's a very big difference between doing tfisa in front of Edom versus tfisa not in front of Edom. If you do tfisa in front of Edom, tfisa doesn't work. Because what does that mean? Normally, the way I do tfisa is I see something from you, there are no witnesses. So we walk into court and I say, you say you took that from me. What do I say? I say, yeah, I took that from you because it's mine. And I win by default because of amigo, because I could have said, I never took it from you. There's no proof to it. And therefore, believe me when I say that you owe me the money because of X, Y, and Z. So here, there is a difference. If I'm tofes, if I'm oven inch dina, if tfisa is called oven inch dina lafshe, according to the Torah, it could be what he means is that you're not allowed to do it in front of Edom, because then you're not going to win your case. It doesn't work. You're not yachal lahotzi b'din, because I'm going to lose ultimately if he denies it and he brings me to Din Torah and I say I have it, but he's going to bring the Edom and say, yeah, but you stole it from me. So, and I say, yeah, but that's because it was mine. Beis Din will say to me, prove it. And if I can't prove it, I'm going to have to give it back. So that might be usur, as opposed to, it might be mutter to do, even though ironically it's more chaotic, to do Avanish Dilnashti, to seize, not in front of Edom, because then I could actually be Motzi Bidin. I would win. It's not being Motzi Bidin, but I would win in the Din Torah. Okay, now the Torah doesn't provide exact parameters. He provides an example. I see the stolen object, but let's say you owe me money for a whole variety of reasons. Would the same rule apply there? So here we have to step back, and the Torah imposes a severe limitation, possibly, on the ability to see something from someone else. And that's the parsha of Lova. So if you owe me money, I'm not allowed to walk into your house to seize a mashkon. An avod is not payment. Very important. It's not payment. It's a mashkon. The Gemara in Bava Metzia has a machlokas whether the shaliach Beis Din is even allowed to go into your a lova's house and take a mashkon, or he has to wait outside as well. Now, that actually is a little bit significant in our discussion, because if you say that a shliach Beis Din is not allowed to enter the person's house, then the fact that I can't doesn't tell you that it's lo avid inish din lenafshe, because after all, it's not dina. If the shliach Beis Din is not allowed to enter to seize a mashkon, then obviously the fact that I can't do it is not because lo avid inish din lenafshe, but rather because it's not dina. But we paskin, and that's one opinion in Tanaim, that in fact the shliach Beis Din is allowed to enter into the house to seize a mashkon, but I, the malve, I, the lender, am not allowed to do so. The question, of course, is how does one understand that particular issue? And here, what's interesting is one can actually raise the question whether this is even actually called din. And what do I mean by that? So this is an observation that the Maharik makes, and which is, din would be going to seize something of yours to keep as a form of collection. Taking a mashkon is actually not din, because taking a mashkon is simply a way of forcing you to come into Beis Din, forcing you to face up to your obligations. So it is conceivable, one could argue, that in fact taking a mashkon is simply a totally different category. And as such, the second thing that comes along with that is, is this a general principle or is this a limited principle? Now, in the answer to that question, it's a very limited principle. I'm not allowed to enter your house to seize a mashkon. But if you're in the street and you're carrying your backpack, I am allowed to seize your backpack as a mashkon, number one. Number two, it would appear that this rule of not being able to take a mashkon is only on a loan, only on a halva. It seems to be really about protecting the indigent, the person who would naturally take out a loan. If you owe me money because you damaged my property, or you owe me money because of all sorts of other reasons that you might owe me money, then this protection may not apply. It may be that I can enter your house. If you're a mazik, I can enter your house to seize a mashkon. Only if you're a lova. If that's the case, it has to be viewed as sort of sui generis. It's unique to the situation of lova. It doesn't apply anywhere else. So it could be that even though normally avadish dil nafshe, mashkon from a lova stands alone. Now, how did the Rishonim deal with this? So there seem to be two major opinions. One is that of the Marami Rutenberg, and it's cited in his student, the Mordechai. And the other is that of the Rivash, who has a tshuva on Simen Shin Sadi Vav, and it's cited by the Ramah in the Darkei Moshe and in the Shulchan Aruch. The Marami Rutenberg's position is that Oven Ishti Lanashe is a very narrow principle. It applies only to a situation where I'm going to seize an object over which I have title already. You stole something from me, you have a pikadon of mine, I go and take that. And the Marami Rutenberg says that one is permitted to do. But to take something, even if I'm entitled, you owe me money, and forget halva. Halva obviously establishes a certain precedent. He says that that would be prohibited. And he brings proof from a very interesting story. The Gemara in Brachos tells the story about Rav Huna that he had 400 barrels of wine that turned into vinegar. So he wanted to know why. What did he do wrong? So the Rabbanan said to him, you know, maybe you're doing something. They said, maybe you're doing something wrong. So he says, well, I don't know. What have I done wrong? If anybody you know, tell me. So they said, we've heard that you've been stealing the vine, the wood of the vines that you're supposed to share with the Aris. So Rav Huna said, what do you mean? That guy is such a ganav. He's been stealing me, robbing me blind right and left. I'm just taking back what's my own. So they said to him, still, you know, stealing from a thief, you know, is not okay. And that's why you've been punished. So of course he did tshuva, and either the vinegar turned it back into wine, or vinegar's price appreciated so much that it was worth the same thing as wine. So anyway, so the Marami Rutenberg says, but then you look at that story, he was taking it was Oven Ishti L'Nafshe. What was wrong with that? So he said that Rav Huna was wrong because Oven Ishti L'Nafshe means only when you're collecting the particular object in question actually belongs to you. If the artist had taken the vines, split them in half and kept both halves, and Rav Huna had gone and seized those vines, that would have been fine. But withholding other property would not have been okay. That was the Maram's opinion. The Rivash, which is cited by the Ramah in Shulchan Aruch, but as the Sma points, we go to the last source.
Quick question.
Yes.
Same thing apply to money, though? Could you say that it would apply specifically to the coins or the bills, but if it was a dollar amount that you could hold any money?
So I think that we would say that would not fit the criteria, because by one of the major principles in Halva is that milva lahutzah nitna, that I don't have to give you back the same dollar bills that I borrowed from you. So I think in general, money is certainly regarded as fungible, and I don't think it would fit the criteria, at least according to the Maram. Now, the Ramah, if you look in the, let's look at the Shulchan Aruch very quickly, the last source. Yachal adam lasus din la'atzmo, im roesh shelo biyat acher, shegzalo. Yachal l'kachto miyado. You can take the object. Im acher ome kenegdo, yachal l'hakoso ad she'anichenu, im lo yuchal atzin l'min acher. You can beat the guy up if you can use physical force, if he stands in your way. Afilu hu davar shem bo hefseid, like Rav Nachman, im yamtin ad she'amidenu badin. Even if you don't stand to lose it, you can take him to the Torah, doesn't matter. You have to be able to win your case. The Mechaber just says you're not allowed to take a mashko. That's a pasuk, right? No, that's not a that you know, whatever the explanation is, that's a pasuk. And as the Ramah says, if you look later in Choshen Mishpat, you'll see the dinim of taking a mashkon from a milva. Then the Ramah says, v'yish omrim dafka b'chovo mamish, avalim chay below halval. If it's either not because of a loan, but some other monetary obligation, or you don't have to take a mashkon because you already have it, and you're just simply going to withhold it from him, or you're taking it from someone else, not from him. So then, mutar, and the sma amends here, and probably correctly so on the basis of Darkei Moshe, mutar le'avedina l'nafshe. It means I'm allowed to seize a mashkon, provided it doesn't violate the narrow parameters of Torah signs, even if it means beating the guy up. Even if it means beating the guy up, I'm allowed to do so. Oved yishdin l'nafshe. So there's a fundamental machlokas here then, really, whether or not I am allowed to take only the object itself that belongs to me, or whether or not I'm actually allowed, I would say, to make things even out properly. Right? In other words, that money is not my money, but you owe me money, so I'm allowed to do whatever's necessary to ultimately protect my own interests. Even though I don't happen to own that object. Now, finally, the last opinion, which is not necessarily arguing on one of these two opinions, is the position of the Marik. The Marik dealt with a particular case of a fight between an individual and the town, and they seized something from him. It had to do with a silver menorah in the Beis Knesses. It's a very important case because it may establish differences between individuals fighting versus individual fighting against the community. If you read on in Shulchan Aruch and in Choshen Mishpat Siman Dalin, but for the purposes of just defining Oven Ishti L'Nafshe, the Marik makes the following claim. He says, excuse me, Tfisa, seizing something from somebody else, that's not called Dina L'Nafshe. That's not called Dina. You know what dina is? Dina means really acting like a beis din. Beis din beats people up. A beis din might take property from someone as collection, as guvaina, as permanent, a permanent collection, not I take a mashkon simply to hold on to. So those are the kinds of things that are called dina. And there, the Maharal Mewurtenberg said that you're not allowed to do that in the course of taking property unless it's actually your property. But the simple, and what was the problem with what Rav Yirmiyah was doing? Rav Huna wasn't taking the withholding a portion of the aris so that he had a mashkon and taking the aris to a din Torah. He was withholding the portion of the aris and keeping it since he was owed money by the aris. That's guvaina. That's called avanish din lanashe, and that you're not allowed to do unless you're taking that which actually belongs to you. But he says tfisa. Tfisa is a totally different issue. We find tfisa all over the place. If all you're doing is seizing something so as to bolster your argument in court, so he says that's not called avanish din lanashe, provided that you don't have to beat the guy up. It means I can seize it, and he's not in the way, and it's really not a problem. The Yam Shel Shlomo in Bava Kamma on this sugya takes great issue with the Ma'arik over this issue. And this is a much larger Shas issue about the question of Tfisa, when are you allowed to do Tfisa, when are you not allowed to do Tfisa. But the Yam Shel Shlomo claims, the Marshal claims, that Tfisa is a form, it is Avadish Dilanafshe, and it is also. And the only time, even though you find many, many times in Shas, the Gemara says, Itafis lo mafkinan mine. Right? If he sees it, then we don't take away from him. So the Marshal says two things. The Amshar Shalma says two things. Number one, Tfisa is only mutter in cases what we would call Sveika Dedina. When there's a question of what the din should be, so he says those are the situations where you're allowed to do Tfisa. But in a situation where there's no question what the halacha is, but rather you're simply trying to protect your own interest. Everybody knows what the din is. And in a sense, we may not know what the facts are, but we know what the din is. So he says, you're not allowed to do Tfisa. That's called Avadish Din Lanafshe. And since the Maram said that Lo Avadish Din Lanafshe, unless you're taking the object itself, the specific object, so he says it's prohibited. He adds, of course, that if you do Tfisa when there are no Edim, you're not allowed to. But obviously it works. It works based on what we explained before, the principle of Migo, that once I seize it, now in court, since there's no testimony that I seize the object from you, so I can always say, look, if you don't believe me that you owe me the money, don't believe me when I admit that I seize the object from you. But anyway, so the Yam Shel Shlomo says that Tfisa is a form of an ishtil nafshe against what the Ma'arik says, and therefore he says it would be prohibited in line of the thinking of the Maram. Now, just a few closing comments, and then I'll take questions. That it's a few loose ends. Firstly, just to explain, what did the Maram Mewurtenberg's position? We understand that unless it's the object in question, you're not allowed to take it. And his proof seems to be a good proof from the story of Rav Huna. What did Rav Huna do wrong? The question might be asked, according to the Rivash, that one is allowed to do Tfisa, and even if that means beating the guy, I mean, you're allowed to act like a Dayan, what was wrong with what Rav Huna did? So here, the Rivash comments in the Tshuva, based upon a Gemara we didn't read, but it's on the source sheet, Ben Bagbag says that if someone else has your object, don't slink into his house to take the object. Confront him and beat the daylights out of him if he won't give you the object. You say, Shalian inotel. In other words, you're not supposed to act in a furtive manner. And the problem with what Rav Huna did was that he didn't go to the aris and say, okay, I'm now withholding this because you've been robbing me. Instead, he just did it in a sneaky fashion. He did it derech geneva, as the Rivash calls it. But if you want to do it outright, it doesn't matter whether or not that's your object or it's simply compensation for the object you're owed. So the Rivash would say that it's permissible. The second piece that I wanted to just ponder for a brief moment and throw out one suggestion to come back to what we started with is what exactly is the machlokas between the Marshal and the Marik about the question of whether tfisa is to be treated like tfisa without physical violence is to be treated like a din Torah or like a din or simply a person acting on his behalf. It's a new animal called tfisa. It's not actually the function of a dayan. So there are just two comments I wanted to make. Number one, if you assume that a shaliach beis din is not allowed to enter the house of the loveh in order to take a mashkon, not just me, then obviously on some level seizing a mashkon is not a function of din. It's a function perhaps of protecting one's own interests, but it's not actually din. And therefore, while the Torah limits it to one particular, does prohibit it, it's limited to one specific context, namely that of entering a lova's house, nowhere else. If, however, you believe, and that would be the Maharik's position, if, however, you believe that a shliach based in is allowed to enter a person's house, but you, as the malva, may not do so, so then tfisa, as the Torah is describing, does seem to be some type of a function of din. And therefore, that would really be the Amshar Shlomo's position. The problem, of course, for the Maharik is it's clear how we paskin on that issue, which is we paskin that a shliach basedin can enter, but a private, but the lender himself can't. So I think there are ways of explaining it, but I'll leave that aside for the moment. The other comment I would just make is that I think that on some level, and I don't know why, but this comes back to the two models of self-defense, the Baba Machteres and the Rodef. Baba Machteres is a function of din. That's Ovid Inish Dina Lenafshe. And the Yamshel Shlomo sees, not clear why, but he sees Tfisa as really being the same type of a thing. That even though there's an element of self-interest in it, nonetheless, it goes beyond just the self-interest, it is a function of a Dayan. Whereas I think that the Maharik is claiming that aside from the, yes, Tfisa could theoretically have an element of din in it, but nonetheless, even in situations where there's an element of Oved Inish Dina Lenafshe, there is also an element of pure self-interest. And just that, just as one is allowed to do things to protect one's own life with a certain degree of limitations, one is also allowed to do things to protect one's own property that are not a function as acting as a dayan, but just as a function of acting in one's self-interest. So I'm not sure. I think it certainly requires further thought. But certainly, I think that it's clear that there is a machlokes between the marshal and the marik. It seems we paskin like the marik about the nature of tfisa. It's certainly clear that we paskin like Rav Nachman that oven in yishti lenashe, a person can in fact in some situations execute justice on their own behalf, even in a situation where going to court, waiting to go to court would not entail a loss. But there is fundamentally a major machlokes between the Marami Rutenberg and the Rivash as to whether that is a very narrow principle limited to situations where I'm actually taking an object to which I already have title, as opposed to the position of the Rivash, where I'm actually allowed to do things to sort of even the score, to make the monetary calculus work out properly. And even if it means that I'm not taking something that belongs to me, I'm allowed to do that. And even if that means having to use physical force in order to enforce my own rights. Any questions?
First, a technical one. On the Shulchan Aruch, the parentheses and Lo Yuchal Etzim B'Yayin Acher, do we know who put that in?
So this brings back, I believe the answer to the question as follows. The citations of sources in the Ramah are not the Ramah. I believe that the long comments, the explanatory comments, are the Ramah. If you look in the earliest printed editions, the ones I can find online, at the digitized book repository that the Jewish National University Library has online, so the earliest, I think in the first printing of Shulchan Aruch that I could find there that had a Ramah was in the 1570s, which is a good 10 to 20 years after the first Shulchan Aruch was printed, and I believe that those comments, there could be an individual comment that doesn't, but I believe that is the Ramah. That, it's already there. Now, I think it's posthumous, that the edition I looked at is already after the Ramah's death, but I assume that early is probably actually there from the Ramah. The source citations are not, and the Achronim frequently point out that the person who put in the citations on the sources is wrong and pointed to the wrong thing.
And then the more general question. So with the tour, mm-hmm. Let's say somebody is absolutely convinced that he sees his cell phone, you have his cell phone, and we'll give it to him, and he beats you, takes the cell phone back, and then it turns out, it really wasn't his cell phone.
Right.
Would he be liable for damages retroactively?
I think so.
Okay, even though he acted consistently with the
I think just on the principle that Adam is muad ba'olam, so the fact that, in other words, in the reality was that even as of the time of you taking the cell phone, so I thought it was my cell phone, but it turns out I was wrong. So as better than a mazik b'shogeg, and a mazik b'shogeg is chayiv.
So Avid Din Lenafshe,
you better be sure.
Taking the risk.
Correct. You better be sure. Yes.
A question about the urgency of the pseda here. If someone is going to run away or they're going to dispose of the property. So in that case, you can't. Is there a difference in the people saying, this is mine and I'm taking it, or I'm going to appropriate this so we can go to base there? Because otherwise, it's going to run away. And similarly, to move it just one side, like, can you detain the person himself and saying, like, I'm going to detain you because we're going to go to base there?
So the answer to
him up, tie him up.
So I think the answer to the first question is that still depends upon the Machlokas, the Maram, and the Rivash. According to the Rivash, most certainly, if he's running away, because that's because you're even if you're beating him up, you're not to seize a piece of property, but just to make sure in the end that the numbers work out properly, that you get what's yours. So Avin Yishti Lanashi. But the Maram would probably say that if you're going to be if you're being Boreach, unless I'm seizing my object, that's not in the purview of Din El Nashe. So it's true I stand to lose money, but there are a lot of things that I can't, you know, presumably I can't kill you if you're about to drop my object off, in other words, off a cliff, right? There are limitations. So even though it's unfair, unless I'm grabbing you to seize the particular piece of property, I think the Marami Rittenberg would say no. With regards to the second question of locking a person up, I think the answer is that is the category of an Ishdil Nafshe. When you lock a person up generally, I think the Gemara in the 8th parak of Baba Kama says, you're liable for Sheves. And if I keep you from going to work, okay, I won't go on much longer. If I keep you from going to work, I haven't locked you up. But I lock you in a room, I'm chayef on Shevis because I have damaged you in that fashion. So presumably, it's in the general category of chavala. I mean, it's a limited chavala. It's not actually wounding your body, but it's subject to the five things you're chayef for on being chovel ba'adam. So I assume the same thing is true here, that if I'm allowed to beat you up, I'm also allowed to tie you up until we take care of it. Yeah, that would be lawful imprisonment. Yes.
You said in the middle that it only works if you're convinced that you could win in Besdin. You have to have proof.
Well, you switched two different formulations there. Maybe you're right. If you're convinced you can win in Besdin, so again the question is so the way it's formulated, so that itself is a machlokes, the Maharik and others. As to what the Marami Rittenberg means, and I don't think he even says it explicitly, but whether or not you actually have to be able to win in Beis Din, or simply you think that you will win in the outcome for whatever reason. That was because the Lova himself, well, the person will be Moda, right? Now, what if I don't have proof, but I suspect that he's dishonest, but not so dishonest, that he'll actually admit if I seize it. So the Marik insists that then absolutely I'm allowed to seize it. If in the end he doesn't admit, and we go to Beis Din, I lose, I have to give it back. But he does say that falls under Avin Ishti L'Nafshe, but others think that that's not correct. Think that unless you can actually win, if you have the proof in hand, then you're not allowed to do it.
If
there are no edim on the seizure, correct. Yes.
Would it be so that in either formulation that in a sense you're not allowed to get punitive damages, in the sense that you're only allowed to get back what was yours, but not
you're asking
punitive.
The question of like knas.
In a sense that, for instance, the person may feel I didn't really lose anything. The person gets back.
Okay,
you know, but he's not really punished.
So I think that the answer to that question revolves around a sugya at the beginning of the 4th parak in Ksubos, which is what is the nature of knas? That's what you're really talking about. Knas means a fine. I steal from you, I have to pay double. And it really, I think, is dependent upon a technical question. See, if I steal from you, I don't owe you kefel until Beis Din awards the kefel. So before Beis Din actually paskins that I owe you kefel, if you're coming to collect, you can't collect kefel, not because lo ein ishdin nafshe, but because it's not din. You're not owed. Once Beis Din issues a psak that I owe you kefel, so that converts knas into mamon for almost all purposes. That's what it's a whole discussion, multiple opinions in Tosfos. For what purposes is the knas converted to mamon? But the simple reading would be that once they paskin in your favor, that kefel is now mamon. So when you're seizing it, the fact that you didn't lose anything on the deal doesn't matter. It's now your property that I possess. Right now, for the Marami Rittenberg, of course, you can never do that because No kefel was ever the object I took from you. But according to the Rivash, you would be able to do so.
Just the premise or concept of asking questions of halacha l'maisa, like the Maharshal was asking in the story of Rav Huna, you know, based upon story in the Gemara, right, and then learning halacha l'maisa from it. Is that like a legitimate approach, or what are the parameters?
You know, the Gemara in Baba Basra, I think Kof Lamed Gimel says, "Ein lemeida mitoch hagadah." And the question is what exactly that means. So I suspect that some of this is in the eye of the beholder. But my sense is that generally, when the Gemara does seem to make a very clear statement that despite Ein Lamein Mitoch Agadah, I would say Agadah there probably means stories of biblical figures that, you know, that are interpolated. But when you're dealing with a particular scenario that involved Amoraim or Tanaim and they did X, Y, and Z, usually I think they will infer from the story. Of course,
The problem is that, as we like this, as the Gemara says on occasion, had the Raploni lav beferish itmar ela michlala itmar. So you never know whether the inference is a correct inference, right? And there really are. You have at least two different interpretations as to what Rav Huna did wrong.
Right, and you don't. I mean, Rav Huna could just posit otherwise. I mean, even if he was acting entirely according to
that. Correct. Right. Right. You could posit that he has a new shita, but they're less likely to do that. They're going to assume that all the shitos are cited in the Sugya Bava Kamma, and therefore Rav Huna is presumably working with the one. But you're correct. It's not beyond the Rishon to say he has a different shita lagamra. Yeah.
The story of the halachic practices of Tanaim Ramurai is not necessarily Agada.
It's, yes, but it's a story. In other words, usually we like to classify things. You know, Agada is the catch-all for everything that's not halacha. Right? It's history, science, midrashim, you know, stories generally. So again, I agree. I think that
if you have a story of like Rabban Gamliel and his sons in the first Mishnah and Brachos,
correct?
Halacha, or is it?
Well, it's most literally an agada. It's something that's told over. But I agree. I think that's probably the distinction.
Right.
Masa Shehaya
is agada.
Masa Shehaya is, well, when it's cited as such, it's always cited as a halachic proof. So when you have a Maisa Shehaya, it's always being cited as such. But when the Gemara in Brachos tells that story, it's not in the context of discussion of an Inish Dinashe. It's in discussing, you know, a theodicy and things like that. I think that's the sugya it's in. So in the context of discussing, let's say, you know, God's justice and what happened and whether Rav Huna behaved in the nicest way he should have behaved, there's the Gemara's expression there is not, when it says that someone who steals after a thief tastes the fruits of Geneva as well, that's more... When I first read that, it sounds to me more like a moral statement than a halachic statement, right? One which is saying that even if you're right, I'll be then, it's a bad thing to be doing, which is the way the Rav Ash really reads it, right? In other words, that he could have taken it, but he shouldn't have taken it in a sneaky fashion. So in other words, the Gemara there is a little ambiguous. Should that be taken as a Masa Shehaya being cited as a halachic precedent, or just a story to teach you generally the way it's nicer, more appropriate to behave?
So if you take the broad view, not that I know that I have aid in that I could win. So I see that Reuven has my cell. I know it's my cell phone, but I can't, the way I can prove it. And I come to you, you're my posek, and I say, I can't prove that it's my cell phone. And if I come to Based it, they won't give it to me. Is it okay if I just go take it?
Well, my question is, how do you know it's your cell phone?
I know.
So if you tell me that it's got scratches on it, and there's no other way it's got scratches, I would tell you, yes, technically, Ovid, you know, putting aside Dina Machos Adina. Dina Machos Adina might change things here. Assuming in a purely halachic society, the answer would be yes.
Philosophically, there would be no...
Would be yes. But I would tell you that you can't slip it or out of his thing like a pickpocket. Right. You have to confront them face to face and say, can I look at that cell phone? When he hands you the cell phone, say, thank you very much. It's mine. Right? As opposed to, or if you're stronger than him, you can just say, excuse me while I please remove your cell phone from your belt. Okay. Last question?
Last question.
I don't know if it's something you mentioned before, but is there any discussion... Under secular, one of the common reasons that people would try to draft something is to have a more favorable court.
So that's the issue of Tfisa. And the Marik claims that Tfisa is not Avinish Dilanafshe. Tfisa is simply to enhance your standing in court, and make your argument on the basis of Migo. That especially if I do it not in the presence of witnesses, and I take your object, you walk in the basement and say, you took my thing. I say, yes, but you owed me money, and I'm going to win because of that.
So here's more likely that I would want to have the court in my town, or the court where I grab it, or is all based in that you pick the court. I mean, the reason someone grabs things in general is because you want to be able to have it in a certain state.
I don't think the halacha recognizes that question of that. That's a jurisdictional question, a separate issue. It doesn't matter which court you walk into. By seizing it, because possession is 9/10 of the law, I now have amigo that if you say you took that from me, I say I did, but it was mine, or but you owed me money, so pay me the money, I'll give it to you back. So Basin says, well, since I could have denied in the first place because you have no proof, therefore I must be telling the truth, and therefore you therefore pay me the money, or it's your object. So.
Okay, thank you. On behalf of Yeshiva University's Alumni Association, I'd like to very much thank Rabbi Weider for this morning's lecture. I'd like to thank Carrie Katsky for hosting this morning, and I'd like to thank all of you for coming. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
So in that case, my